Welcome to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the podcast where we uncover the secrets of CEOs, entrepreneurs, and visionaries who've used public speaking to skyrocket their businesses and their bottom line. Get ready for captivating stories, valuable insights, and practical wisdom from the trailblazers who've mastered the art of the stage. I'm your host, Kelly O'Hara, and I'm thrilled to bring you their experiences and expertise directly to you. Let's get started. Welcome back to the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight, the show where we skip the fluff and get real about how public speaking doesn't just elevate your message, it transforms your entire trajectory. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and today's guest, he's not just here to inspire, he's here to redefine what resilience looks like when paired with purpose, grit, and a voice that refuses to be silenced. This isn't a feel-good story. It's a feel-everything story. It's about rising up over and through every barrier that says you can't and turning it into a megaphone that says, watch me. Ken Kunkin broke his neck in a college football game at Cornell. The injury left him paralyzed from the shoulders down, and that could have been the end of the story, but for Ken, it was only the beginning. This man has quite the rare pedigree. He's the first quadriplegic to graduate from Cornell University and went on to earn three graduate degrees, both a Bachelor of Science degree in engineering and a Master of Arts degree in education from Cornell. And then Ken also earned a Master of Education degree in psychology from Columbia University and a Juris Doctor degree from Hofstra's University School of Law. But that's not all. Ken has testified before the United States Senate Health Subcommittee, become a nationally certified rehabilitation counselor, and a deputy bureau chief in the Nassau County DA's office. And Ken is a husband to his wife, Anna, and in his spare time, he's a father to triplets, and now a published author and powerhouse speaker who spent decades breaking barriers in courtrooms, in classrooms, and on the stage. His memoir, I Dream of Things That Never Were, The Ken Kunkin Story, is a raw, gripping journey through trauma, triumph, and the audacity of hope. And today, he's bringing that same fire to this conversation. You're gonna find that Ken's story is more than motivation. It's proof that speaking up, standing tall, even from a wheelchair, and sharing your truth loudly can change the way people think, lead, and live. Ken, it's with great pleasure that I welcome you to the spotlight.
Thank you, Kelly, and thank you for having me as your guest.
Oh, I love this. I can't wait to dive into this. You've lived through what most people would call impossible, not only from some of the challenges that you've had, but the things that you've accomplished. It's like somebody who's 10 men has accomplished all this. I was really stunned researching you. But I want to go back. This is always one of my favorite parts of the show, is to go back to where it all began and what put you on your journey, because I think that people relate to that more than anything else, the story of what happened to you and how you ended up here and what your why is and why you are so valuable to what you bring to this planet. So I'd like to ask you, can we rewind it a little bit? And what did you think that your life was going to be before that football game at Cornell?
Well, very different than it turned out. At the time, I was studying industrial engineering because my strongest subject had always been math. And quite frankly, I was also thinking that I may become an actuary. And I was scheduled just a few days after my accident to take the first actuarial exam. So I pictured a life very different than the one I eventually pursued.
So with something like that, this kind of injury is life-changing. There were probably 100 reasons to stop. What made you say, no, I'm going to keep going and I'm going to do more than survive? What is that mechanism in you? That did that come from an upbringing that you have? Did that come from a set in stone mindset that was already in place? Where's this come from?
Oh, it certainly came from the upbringing that I had and continue to have with my family. They have been so supportive every step of my way, every aspect of my life. And Kelly, you probably don't know, but excuse me, My family started facing adversity virtually as soon as I was born. I was born in 1950 during the polio epidemic, and unfortunately, my mother died just 27 days after I was born.
Whoa.
So she died from polio. And in fact, at that time, my older brother Steve, who's 2 years older, had polio, but fortunately, his was a mild case, and he totally recovered. So we learned early on the importance of family, because my family bounded, came together and really helped us every step of the way. And I owe everything that I did back then and everything I've done since to the help and support of my family.
Oh, I love to hear that. I honestly do. Sometimes I think here in America, we get spread out so much. A lot of us don't all live next to our entire families. I'm always envious of the people that all their cousins and their brothers and sisters, everybody is living within the same city. A lot of people are spread across the country, and it goes to show you when things are really tough, there's nothing like family. There's nothing like good, solid family.
Absolutely. And you mentioned my cousins who helped a lot, my aunt, uncle, all helpful, but in particular, my grandparents played such a significant part of my life. And they encouraged me right from the beginning that while I had a physical injury, my mind was still intact. And they encouraged me to do as much as I can to lead a useful and productive life by making the best use of my mind.
Oh, clearly that's paid off. But I look at this and I go, okay, so this is part of the reason why you see opportunity instead of limitation. It's one thing to get through something and survive, but it's another to actually take this and turn it into many opportunities. But was there like a specific moment? Maybe it was quiet, maybe it was dramatic that you realized this is what I'm meant to do. Did that happen?
Well, there are a number of things, Kelly. First, let me just say to you and your listeners, I was very motivated before my injury. You don't go to Cornell, study engineering, play sports at the same time, and not be highly motivated. So I had to work really hard to remain motivated and not let my injury stop me from being that way. But if you talk about specific incidents, while I was still in the rehab facility, it seemed like the best the medical personnel ever thought I'd be able to do would be to someday sell magazine subscriptions over the telephone. And that really upset me. Here, I had been studying engineering at one of the finest institutions in the country, let alone the world. I had a physical injury, not an injury to my head. And yet, here they place such limitations on the expectations they had for somebody with a physical disability that really upset me. And once again, my family encouraged me that if need be, they would act as my arms and legs to make sure I could still do everything I wanted to do with my life.
You really are all about it takes a village. It takes a village. But I look at you've earned multiple advanced degrees. You've navigated physical and societal barriers. You've built a legal career that most people only dream of. When you look back, what helped you push through the disbelief of others to create the life you believed in? Your family believed in you, but in all those scenarios, there have to be people that thought, that's great, good for you, but I don't know that we're going to push you to the front of the class. Or I'm imagining you're dealing with clients, you're dealing with other people that are in a very competitive industry. What is it that internally that you could give credit to that didn't stop you at any of these things?
There are a number of things. Firstly, my family worked so hard to make sure I could do everything that I wanted to do that I felt I'd be disappointing them if I didn't take advantage of all the help they were giving me to do something productive with my life. And while I was in the rehab facility, there was a vocational counselor named Joyce Mesh who encouraged me to make my own decisions, to do what I thought was best for me, what I thought would be right. And she felt if I made my own decision, I would work especially hard to make it the right decision. So every step of the way, I wasn't sure if I made the right decision, but I worked hard to make it into the right decision. So when I went back to Cornell, I don't know if people would have said that was the wisest thing to do. This was 20 years before the Americans with Disabilities Act took effect. And Cornell was on a particularly inaccessible campus. It was on a very hilly terrain. Virtually every one of its classes had steps in front of the building, and there was not one ramp or curb cut on the entire campus. So, just to tell you a little bit more about that, one of the classes that I took, which met 3 times a week, was located in a building that had 16 steps in front of it. And my dorm room was in a building that had 10 steps just to get in. So on my first day of class, I had to be either pulled up or bounced down close to 100 steps just
Oh
to
my
go
God.
and attend my first day. And I remember when I got back to my dorm room, I had my attendant, my personal care attendant, lay me down in bed, and I was staring at the ceiling, thinking I must be crazy to have gone back to school so soon after I got out of the rehab facility. I was only out of the rehab facility 11 days before I went back to school. And I
What?
remember lying there thinking, what was I thinking, going back to school so soon? And I realized I didn't have a plan B. There was no other alternative at that point. I knew I had to do my best to make it succeed. And I worked especially hard and had a lot of help from my personal care attendants and my classmates to finish the next 2 years of my schooling, my junior and senior year, during those next 2 years.
Though, as you're telling this story, and this is one of my favorite parts about this, about doing this show, is that when people share their story, you get to know what their why is, but you also get to see how everything that happens, there is a reason. There are no coincidences, I believe. I think things that they happen for a reason. And if you look at it, you ended up speaking in front of the Senate subcommittee under Senator Kennedy. And part of that, I'm sure, comes from I'm sure part of that relates very well to the fact that here you are, someone with a major disability that's having to do 100 stairs. Talk about all the other things to overcome, but 100 stairs a day. And it takes you and an attendant. Who better to go speak in front of the subcommittee, the Senate subcommittee, than you, because you're experiencing it firsthand.
Well, thank you. I might add that 100 steps was only the first day. Most other days were less than 100, but a lot of steps each day. But when I spoke at the Senate Health Subcommittee, that was while I was still in the rehab facility before I went back to school. And the reason why Senator Kennedy asked me to speak was because my father was an insurance salesman. And my father would testify that there was no insurance policy adequate enough to cover an injury such as mine. So that was particularly important for what Senator Kennedy wanted to hear, because he was looking into improving the healthcare system. So I was there, obviously, to put a human face on it. And once I was asked to speak, it really surprised me at the attention that it got. And in fact, 8 days after my testimony, Senator Kennedy sent me a glass paperweight in the mail that had an inscription on it that the senator said his late brother Robert Kennedy liked very much. And the words on that inscription have always been really meaningful to me. The inscription read, "Some men see things as they are and say why. I dream of things that never were and say why not." And that's where I got the title of my book, I Dream of Things That Never Were.
Explain, boy. Yeah, that's beautiful. I love that. And yes, that quote is very familiar. That's pretty wild. That's a pretty wild story. So you now we're going to talk about your book next, but I want to say that you are proof that limitations don't define legacy. Your values, you've had all this help from your family. Clearly they have values, but I find it fascinating that you deal in systems that weren't designed to accommodate you, and you managed to go to three different colleges and manage through these challenges, and then to end up in the law. And that's a big question. You ended up doing this. You were in the law profession for 40 years. What drew you to the legal world and what kept you there for such a long time? What was it about the law you loved?
There were two different things that attracted me to law. One, my older brother Steve was a lawyer at the time. In fact, he worked as a defense attorney. I later became a prosecutor. But what happened is, while I was working before law school, I was working as a vocational rehabilitation counselor, where I was counseling other individuals who had severe disabilities. And this was at the Viscardi Center here on Long Island, named after Dr. Henry Viscardi Jr., who was a very impressive individual who did a lot to help people with disabilities. And part of my duties involved speaking before groups and organizations concerning affirmative action and non-discrimination for people with disabilities. And often after my talks, I would be asked questions. And while I would certainly do my best to respond to the questions, I was always careful to caution the questioners they should really speak with a lawyer about their concerns. And I guess it didn't take long before I started to think there's no reason why I couldn't become that lawyer. So I left that job and went to Hofstra University School of Law.
Oh, amazing. Talk about, I see a need. I'll fill it today. I'll immediately start filling it. You don't let any grass grow under your feet or the chair, nothing. You just go for it. I just think that is such an exciting perspective. So let's talk about your book. You have this incredible book. Now we know where the title comes from, I Dream of Things That Never Were, the Ken Kunkan story. What made you sit down and decide, okay, it's time to tell my story in full?
I originally started working on the book while I was still a patient in the rehab facility. A good friend of my aunt Lorraine, by the name of Albert Meglin, visited me in the rehab facility. I was at the Rusk Institute in New York City. He knew I was very depressed at the time, but he also said to me, most people don't know what takes place in a rehab facility. And certainly people didn't know much about spinal cord injuries back then. Keep in mind, I was injured about 25 years before Christopher Reeve's injury. Now,
Wow.
following Christopher Reeve's injury, there was a lot more attention paid to people with spinal cord injuries. But when I was injured in 1970, most people knew very little about it. So he thought it would be very informative to others to let them know what it was like and what I was going through. So he visited me a number of times in the rehab facilities, and I would talk to him and tell him what was happening. And then, of course, we stopped because I went back to school. And we'd start again on vacations and stop again. And finally, I didn't work on it for a number of years. And then when I married my incredible wife, Anna, which, I married Anna in 2003, Anna encouraged me to go back to the book and finish writing it. So we sat down when we had some spare time, and Anna was sitting by her laptop computer and asking me about my background and what happened, and I would dictate to Anna. And it was not an easy thing to do. For one, I was reliving in detail the most difficult, depressing times of my life, which was very difficult to go back and think about extensively. And two, I was always a bit of an introvert. I would never like sharing much about my personal life. And Anna kept trying to pull it out of me. You've got to say more about what you were feeling at the time, what you were going through. How were you able to do this? So it was a slow process. And from the day I started the book in the rehab facility to the day it was published was more than 50 years. But I'm so glad it's out there now.
50 years in the making. That's a pretty big deal here. If a young reader picks up I Dream of Things That Never Were, what's the one message that you hope that they will absorb immediately? Something that might take them years to learn otherwise.
There are a
A big
number of messages. For one, just because something has never been done before doesn't mean you can't do it now. You have to believe in yourself. You've got to work especially hard, maintain a positive attitude, and defy expectations. Just because somebody may have limited expectations of what you can do doesn't mean you can't rise above those expectations and make the impossible possible.
No, you said, in the research that I did on you, you said your life has been shaped by others' low expectations. And then you turn around and write a book like this. You're really trying to shift for the reader what's truly possible, aren't you?
Absolutely. I had people encourage me to do public speaking and talk about my life and try to motivate people well before I even got married and became a father. And I used to say to them, I didn't feel I had done anything special. Yes, I went back to school and yes, I was working, but I just really didn't feel I had done anything special. But I remember after I got married, and after, as you indicated, we had triplet boys who are all doing incredibly well. They're now 20 years old and studying at three separate colleges in upstate New York. And they're all very healthy and very active. But triplets are always born prematurely. And I remember shortly after they were born, they were all in incubators in the neonatal intensive care unit. And I remember sitting by their incubators, and suddenly it just dawned on me, whoa, this is big. This is a story that really needs to be told. And that really got me motivated that I really needed to work on the book and share with others exactly what my story entailed.
I don't want to leave out what is really an important part of this story. Just say triplets alone and then an ICU, and we just want to grab your wife and hug her and say, yay, you, because that is incredibly powerful. But I'd love it if you told us, how did you meet?
Actually, I met my wife back in 1999. I was actually looking for a personal care attendant to help me with my daily needs. And what I used to do was put an ad in the newspaper and a help wanted ad to get people responding, and then I would interview them. And somebody suggested to put an ad in the Polish Daily News, which was published in New York, because they said a lot of people look at that newspaper and respond. And I was fortunate. My wife happened to be visiting from Poland at the time. She came here to improve her English speaking skills. She saw the ad, and despite never having done this work before, she responded. And that's how I met my future wife. And we began by her working as my weekend personal care attendant. And the more I got to know Anna, the more our relationship developed into one, a very close friendship, and then eventually into a romantic relationship, and then eventually our marriage and the birth of our triplet sons.
It's just incredible, honestly, what you two together, because, you know, there's no better partnership in the world than a great marriage. That's amazing. But I look at the two of you and how you care for each other, how she's such an important part of your story. I can't even imagine. My brother has twins, and I remember them feeling a little daunted at the beginning of this, and they were fine, okay? A couple of nannies. You're fine. And I look at you, what you're having to do. And Anna, you're heroic as well. You are equally heroic managing all that. There's a lot to tell about that. But let me ask you, that means that when you speak, she's very much part of that, helping that happen for you. I love it that you shared that a little bit early. You intimated that speaking was not your first thing. That was that you hadn't found your voice yet. And now here you are, an accomplished speaker. I think that would be very helpful for people to know, because it's one thing to have this incredible education and all this accomplishment. It's helpful. It's good to know what you're talking about and to have a pedigree of information that people want to listen to. But it's another thing to get up there when, you know, you're either an introvert or you're different, you're rolling up on the stage. That's a little bit different experience. I want you to speak to those people that are introverted, those of us who aren't charging the stage. And the last thing we want to hear is, oh, come and speak to 5,000 people. A lot of people say, I'd rather die first than do that.
There were
I
many
guess.
times I felt that way. And I indicated I was an introvert before my injury. I used to sit in the very back of these large lectures at Cornell and hope nobody would notice me and never raise my hand. And if they would have put in another row behind the back row, I would have moved back one more row to sit there. And following my injury, because of my physical limitations, everything I do now really needs to be verbal. I have to tell people what I need, what needs to be done, what I want to do. So I have to use my voice more. And people used to encourage me to go out and do speaking, and I definitely didn't want to do it. But while I was still a student at Cornell, I met a woman going to Ithaca College, whose name happened to be Betsy Ross. And Betsy encouraged me to speak at Ithaca College to her physical therapy classmates. And that was the first real talk I did following, other than testifying before the Senate Health Subcommittee. And
Interact. Just that small thing. Okay.
I spoke at Ithaca College before well over, I guess, over 50 people, maybe 100. And it was very intimidating, but I knew it was
Course.
mostly talking about my personal experiences. But I was surprised that I had also gotten a call from Dryden High School in upstate New York, from the principal there, asking me to speak at the Dryden High School graduation. And that
Wow.
shocked me. Here, I didn't think anybody even knew who I was, let alone ask me to be the speaker at the graduation. And here, this would not just be answering questions. This was in 1973, and I had to prepare a speech. And it was really intimidating. And I had a good friend help me prepare a speech. And I was so nervous to get up in front of this group. And I was told that there'd be 125 graduates. And I'm thinking, oh my goodness, speaking in front of 125 people. And then it occurred to me, wait a minute, each graduate is probably going to have two parents coming there. That's another 250. Now we're talking about 375 people. And suddenly I get there and there are about 1,000 people. Where they came from, I don't know. But I was so nervous. And I start speaking and a baby starts crying in the audience. And now this is really difficult because I have to speak louder. And while I'm speaking, my voice goes totally dry. And the water pitcher that I had with me was left back where I had been sitting before I was wheeled up to the microphone. So I didn't have the water. And what happened since my injury, I get a lot of muscle spasms where my arms start shaking a lot. And I felt a big muscle spasm coming on. And I'm sitting there going, oh no, before all these people. So I tried to remain even stiller than I normally am sitting in this chair and talk in a low voice to see if maybe I could avoid the spasm. And there was a very loud air conditioner rattling in the background. And I vowed I will never, ever do this again. And that didn't last long because I started being asked to deliver a lot of public speaking talks.
Amazing. I love this story, first of all, to all the people out there who just it tortures them to think of getting up on top of the stage. And I remember those days. Trust me, I do. And how fearful it is, how you just imagine the worst case scenario. And then you get up there, most of the time, what you're afraid of doesn't happen. But sometimes it does. And I got to ask you, when that happened to you under very difficult circumstances, what was the experience like afterwards? How did, just that one, let's just take that one, the one that really was overwhelming for spasms and you can't get water and you're having to talk in this low voice. How did that change you?
I really didn't know how my talk was going to be received. And when I finished my talk, I received a long and loud standing ovation. And nobody was more surprised than I was. And the principal had arranged ahead of time that they were going to pay me a small amount of money for giving the talk, which I thought was very nice. And After the speech, he apologized, said, "I don't have the check ready. I'll mail it to you." And I was surprised when I got the check a week later that he doubled the amount that they were going to give me and really just praised my talk and how much he thought that meant to the students. And that just made me feel great. I was so surprised that I never thought I could do public speaking in front of a group. And then, of course, I had spoken at Ithaca College. I was asked to speak at Cornell Medical School, and it just seemed to take off that I was being asked to speak at different places.
This is meant to be. And I'd love to know what you found is the difference between telling your story privately and then owning it publicly on the stage. Would you say that this has just changed the trajectory of your life?
Oh, absolutely. And again, being an introvert, I tried to keep my private life very private. I did not want to share it with people. And here I am talking before large groups of people about my personal life and in a lot of detail. And I was shocked that people not only found it interesting, but they seemed to be hanging on every word that I was saying. And all types of different groups were asking me to speak. I was speaking before athletes, before lawyers, judges, rehab professionals, people that were business owners, construction workers, and most of my talks, with the exception of the graduation speech, I did without any notes in front of me. I would just get up and talk, and I was always nervous that one day I am just going to go blank and sit there and have no idea what to say. And I might add that when I became a lawyer, I did a lot of trial room work. I was a trial attorney. And I remember before my first summation, I decided I was going to do it without notes, just talk about the case. And before I was to give my summation, I started to panic, thinking, what was I thinking not to have my summation all written out in front of me? So I was able to, I had the splint in my arm. I could move my left arm a little bit, and I had a pen in my splint, and I was able to just write one word on my pad. I wrote confidence. That was the only thing I had in front of me. And I got up in front of the jury and I started speaking, and I got a little nervous, and I looked down and I saw confidence, and I just broke out in this broad smile and just continued. And I got through it and it went pretty well. And I did it ever since with doing my summations without any notes in front of me. And often they would be 1 hour summations. And I was fortunate that they usually went pretty well.
This is the perfect chance for everybody who's listening, who has that fear. It's a deep-seated fear. And the funny thing, and I've been through it myself, in a situation of, speaking in front of an industry that I had been in for less than 2 years, and the panic, the fear of, oh my God, these are all colleagues and they're all more experienced than I am. Why did I get asked to do this? Why am I doing this? Okay, whatever I did, I don't want to talk about it. You can go check the results and get back to me. But no, I had to speak. And I remember thinking, there's just got to be a way out of this. I just really don't want to do this. And I had 18 million excuses. But the thing about it is, when you get up to speak, it is you're getting up and overcoming a deep fear. And it's most people's biggest fear besides dying. And it's crazy to think which one they're more scared of, because most people are more scared of public speaking. But when you take on a fear like that, it changes you. That level of confidence is different. It's different than developing a skill set, and you get a lot of practice at it. But when you get up there and face a fear, no matter how it turns out, like you said, this was such a great story, because the first time you did it, oh my gosh, what could go wrong did go wrong, which could be very terrifying. But you show up and you just get through it. It's very empowering. It's amazing what happens after that. And the other thing I always tell people is, guess what? When you get up there on the stage, they are for you. The audience is for you. 90% of those people in the audience don't want to be you. They don't want to be up on the stage. And they're so grateful that you took the lead and you got up there. And so they really are your champions most of the time. I find that amazing that you can really walk off and you've changed. So do you encourage others, especially when you deal in the world of people with disabilities or who've had to face major adversity, do you recommend that they use public speaking as a tool?
Absolutely. For those that can, I definitely encourage it. And part of the reasons why I do it now is to advocate for people with disabilities and to encourage employers to hire people with disabilities, because they often make some of the best and most loyal workers that an employer can ever hope to have. So I feel that's part of my reason for continuing to do public speaking, to advocate for people with disabilities. I might add, Kelly, that when I went to school, you indicated that I earned not just a bachelor's degree from Cornell, but a master's degree from Cornell, a master's degree from Columbia, and I couldn't get a job. This was now 1975. I am looking for a job for a year. I sent out more than 200 resumes, and despite my three Ivy League degrees, two master's degrees, everybody felt I was just too disabled to work. I couldn't even volunteer my services until the Viscardi Center hired me. That's what it was like having a disability and trying to get a job. So fortunately, it's improved a lot since then, but it's still a challenge for so many people. And there are so many people with disabilities that are great communicators, that have a story to tell and can help so many others if they're given that opportunity to do so.
Couldn't agree more. And Ken, here's a thought that I'd love to share, because I don't think the world is a cold place. I don't choose to look at it that way. I think there's a lot of good people out there. But I'm going to say to all of you out there, since public speaking is part of my program, part of what I'm here to do is to let people know, listen, your voice is what sets you apart. But in this particular situation, as you said, there's a lot of people with disabilities that have incredible capabilities, and they are the most loyal employees. Most people that really have to work to get a job really take care of keeping a job. I think there's always, so I want to add this, I think that there are people out there that want to hire, but they're afraid, not that the person that they do want to hire them, they're afraid if it doesn't work out, they'll be the ones that say, they don't want to be the ones to say, this isn't working out, you're going to have to go now. And so they'll just avoid hiring that person. And I'm going to say that one of the tools you can do to set yourself apart is to get out there and speak and let people get to know you. It takes the fear out of it. It opens up the conversation. It creates that feeling before you ever go for the job that, no, really, I'm viable, I'm excited, and there's value here. And really, the only way you'll ever get that is if you can get the word out ahead of time. And maybe it'll happen before you get to an interview. So go to networking groups. Get involved with organizations. Let them get to know you first. Is there anybody that's out there in the audience right now, after hearing Ken, would not want him to speak at their events, would not want him to be part of their board, would not want them, not want him to be at your dinner table? He's interesting. He's engaging. He's got purpose. He's got value. He has so much substance to offer, more than most. Sincerely, when I was reading this bio, and now I'm studying this, finding out about this guy, and I'm going, you have done more in this lifetime than 10 people. It's ridiculous. And all doing that as a quadriplegic, it's ridiculous. I can't even, I'm so impressed. And married, no less. Most of the country can't do that successfully. At least 50% of those go south. And then raise three children that are all in college now and are happy. No, I just think you scream success all over the place.
Thank you. I appreciate it. But I just have to repeat, I've had so much help along the way. Now from my incredible wife, but before that, from my close relatives, that included grandparents, aunts, uncles, brothers, sister, cousins. I've been so fortunate that I've had that help and that encouragement. and that my family had high expectations for me. And that really made a big difference. I might add, Kelly, that at the district attorney's office, firstly, when I was hired, Dennis Dillon, who was the district attorney at the time, was a very progressive, forward-thinking district attorney who based his hiring decision on my abilities rather than my disability. And he seemed to know that when I went to court, a jury was not going to base its verdict on my inability to walk, but rather on my skill and competence as an attorney. And that proved to be right. And now I might add that when you leave your job in the district attorney's office, you usually go through an exit interview where they asked you what you liked best about the job and what you thought could be improved. And I was told on a number of occasions by the person in personnel conducting the interviews that a number of my fellow assistant district attorneys said one of the best parts of their job was meeting, working with, and getting to know me. And I'm not saying that to boast or brag. I know what they were referring to is meeting, working with on a daily basis somebody with a significant physical disability. Because unless they had a close relative with a disability, they never came in contact with somebody an extended period of time who had a disability. And for many of them, it was quite a revelation that we are no different than they are. We have the same hopes, desires, and needs, that it doesn't require any additional work for them to be working alongside somebody with a disability, and that it really helped motivate and inspire them to do a better job. And just to go further on that point, 2 years ago, the current district attorney, Ann Donnelly, started an annual award, the only award our district attorney's offers on an annual basis, that she named the Kenneth J. Kunkin Award. And they did that to recognize and honor the outstanding assistant district attorney each year who best demonstrates the work ethic and the loyalty and devotion to the office and the positive effect that person has had on his or her colleagues as the guy in the wheelchair. So when you think about, there are some people now that seem to have a negative opinion of DEI, of diversity, equity, and inclusion. They should speak to some of my colleagues at the district attorney's office, and they'll tell them that it doesn't just benefit a particular individual, it benefits everybody else working with that individual.
Does it we need to access our empathy more often and finding what is alike about us, not just what's different, but to embrace what's different. We would not all want to be the same. That would be boring. If we all had exactly the same, be boring. So it's really good to reach out. Now, if you could sit down with your 20-year-old self and you could, even just after this accident, what would you whisper to him about what's coming? What's one thing you would say to him?
I thought when I was in a rehab facility, my life was over. I thought there was nothing I would ever be able to do in life, whether it be going back to school, where at the time I had difficulty even turning pages of a book, whether I could ever eventually get a job, which they thought may be selling magazine subscriptions over the telephone. I thought my personal life was going to be so limited that certainly I would never even think of marriage, let alone becoming a parent. I would have to tell my 20-year-old, there's an awful lot you'll still be able to do with life. Now, when I was injured, as I indicated, this was 25 years before Christopher Reeve, I did not have a role model that I could look to say somebody with my disability could do some of these things. There may have been people out there, but I hadn't heard about them. So I'd like to think that there are a lot of role models out there now to encourage people that there's an awful lot you can do if you maintain a positive attitude, work hard, continue to improve, and not be afraid to take chances or make difficult choices.
So here you are, and you're the role model, and you actually are the role model for you because you made it all happen. I think this is phenomenal. I think you have an incredible legacy. I love that you shared. What is that? What you feel your legacy is?
Well, my first legacy of my three triplet sons, to me, watching them grow up and become the fine young men that they are, that's the legacy I'm most proud of. But yeah, I'm hoping that my legacy will encourage other people to not only help and support people with disabilities, but to employ them in the workforce, to listen to them when they talk about what their needs and desires are, and to treat them no differently than they treat anybody else.
Such an important message right now. And I just want to thank you for not only coming on the spotlight, but for really dropping anchor in the kind of truth that shakes people awake. I can't tell you how appreciative I am of you coming on the show today. It has been phenomenal.
Thank you, Kelly. And thank you for giving me the opportunity to share my story with your listeners.
That's so important. Honestly, when I first started researching you, preparing for this interview, I was astonished at the level of accomplishment that you've achieved. It's just, you've done this under incredibly tough circumstances. You set an amazing example in your tenacity and really your refusal to accept limits. It's the kind of story we don't just need to hear, we need to carry with us, especially now. You've got this incredible amount of change and division. And there's so much adaptation that's going to have to be required. And when you start feeling like you can't, and you don't have enough time, or it's just too much, or I can't do this, think Ken Kunkin because he rocks. I'm sorry. It's just amazing to me that anybody could have a bad day around you. It would have to be, okay, let's get on with it. You got another couple minutes, let's get on to it. So you're really proof that resilience, especially these days, look, it's not a buzzword. It's built in the trenches. It's built in hard days. And through that quiet voice, I think that everybody has, if they're listening, that says, I believe there's still more. I listen to a lot of people out there that lose hope. And I think, are you kidding? Tomorrow's another day. Today might suck. Tomorrow is another day. You don't know what's coming. You just don't know, and it's all meant for you. And nothing can be taken from you that isn't yours to have. It's not going to get done. So you might be here for a mission, but I know you're here for a mission. And thank you for your perspective on public speaking, because I love that you share. Here you're a guy with incredible education and accomplishment and overcoming physical challenges, so everything else should look easy. I love hearing that you're an introvert that did not want to get on the stage, that did not feel they had anything to say. Amazing. We all underestimate ourselves. And don't do that because you're here. And Ken has used his voice to build bridges and to knock down barriers and light the way for others who didn't even know they needed a path. That's why you're here, Ken. So, for more on Ken and the work that he's doing, check out his website at kenkunkin.com. And if you get a chance, you want to read his memoir. It's I Dream of Things That Never Were, the Ken Kunkin story. It's on Amazon, of course. And it's the kind of book that rewires the way you think about adversity and perseverance and what's possible. I don't think there's a better time to read a book like this. Once again, I also will say, can you see public speaking? It's not just about performance, it's about power to shift perceptions and create impact and to invite others to believe in what they thought was impossible. Ken does that all the time. That's the real gift of owning your voice. So I hope you loved this conversation as much as I did. I can't wait to have you back again, Ken. You're just a dream guest. You know what to do, everybody. If you like it, share it. Send it to somebody that needs to hear it. Subscribe to the show. Let us have a comment. Let us know. We do read them and they keep us all going. And we're here to keep spotlighting how public speaking can turn a message into a movement and a career into a calling. Really, so much bigger. It's so much bigger than just that job. There's so much you have to offer. And with that said, I'm delighted to say thank you, Ken. I can't wait to see you again. Thanks for everybody to come into the show. And as always, I look forward to our next conversation. See you next time, and bye-bye, Anna.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. for joining us for this episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight. We hope you enjoyed this deep dive once again into the remarkable stories and insights of our incredible guests. Their experiences and hard-earned, time-tested wisdom are not just meant to inspire you, but to provide you with actionable steps to take on your own path to success. Remember, you have a story to tell, and your voice has the power to transform your business and make lasting impact. And that's what it's all about. If you found value in today's episode, let us know. And I hope you'll take a moment and subscribe to The Spotlight wherever you listen to your podcasts so you never miss a thought-provoking or idea-producing conversation. I'm Kelly O'Hara, and I can't wait to see you back here for the next episode of the Six Figure Speaker Spotlight.